We'll give a minute for the rest of the audience to clear. I've been under the impression they're all waiting to hear you people argue. But... That's one of the reasons we'll give them a minute. They sometimes make racket going out. So. Your time won't start running till you start talking. You may begin, Ms. Yodis.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Kathleen Yodis, and I represent Mr. Mannin before this honorable court. What we have here today is a very experienced airman who was charged with intentional falsification, who denied that charge, but was found in violation of that charge without his day in court, without a meaningful opportunity to defend himself. And what I'd like to point out to Your Honors this morning especially is a fact I
hesitate. I know you're just beginning, but you really have to be careful when you begin an argument with a statement like that. He had no meaningful opportunity to defend himself.
Yes, sir.
It was an evidentiary hearing that was held before the ALJ, and he could have testified but didn't.
Your Honor.
Why wasn't that a meaningful opportunity to defend himself?
Well, I respectfully disagree that there was an evidentiary hearing. The parties did come and appear before Judge Fowler for purposes of a hearing.
Denied summary judgment.
I'm sorry?
Didn't the ALJ first deny summary judgment and then have a hearing in which the FAA introduced the various documents, including the notations of your client's convictions?
There were cross motions for summary judgment, written ones prior to hearing, which the judge summarily denied, correct.
And
then we went to hearing, and at the beginning of the hearing, the FAA, in preliminary matters that were discussed back and forth, and the FAA's beginning to put evidence into record as a preliminary matter. At that time, the FAA renewed its motion for summary judgment, and the discussion between the parties ensued at that point.
But it was only after your client, that it was the renewal, the sequence that occurred is the FAA introduced its evidence and then rested. And instead of an evidentiary showing, the attorney, it wasn't you, but the attorney for your client, got up and he made a legal argument rather than producing either your client or any other evidence.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree that there was a production of evidence in the nature of the evidentiary hearing. It was in the nature of preliminaries that the FAA attorney put certified records and court documents, as I recall, into evidence, and the judge asked the counsel for Mr. Mannin, would you have any objection, and he indicated no, and then that's when the judge said, okay, we'll do it in the course of your case, which the FAA attorney indicated he was going to put a person on the stand for purposes of bringing those documents in and also for purposes of clarifying the timing of the FAA's prosecution of the case.
Well, but that wasn't necessary when there was no objection.
Whether it was necessary or not at that point, again, the dialogue amounted then to the motion for summary judgment, and there was not an evidentiary hearing on the merits that were presented by the pleadings and other documentation prior to trial. Mr. Mannin was precluded that opportunity by reason of the motion for summary judgment and the judge's granting of that motion. And what was in direct issue in this case was, in fact, Mr. Mannin's knowledge. And I'd like to point out something that I don't believe is evident in our briefs, that Mr. Mannin's case before the administrative law judge and before the NTSB were all decided prior to this court's decisions in the Singleton and the Dillman case. So at the time, the parties were arguing the case under the NTSB case law as it existed prior to this court's reversal of the Dillman and Singleton decisions by the NTSB and the cases going back, which specifically held that intentional falsification requires a showing of intent by the airman to put down the wrong answer, actual knowledge. That was not done here. What was done here from the judge's decision and the board's decision was that because The events occurred, and because Mr. Mannin knew of the events, that was tantamount to intentional falsification.
There's a big difference between this case and Dillman, though, isn't there?
I don't believe there's necessarily a difference in the law.
Dillman testified.
Mr. Dillman's case, there was an actual hearing on the merits, which did not occur in this case, again, because the summary judgment motion precluded that. But if you'll read through Mr. LaMonica's counsel below, representing Mr. Mannin, and I can point out the references, he was identifying that the issue of intent remained in dispute. We still haven't gotten there.
I want it to be absolutely certain. Number one, your client didn't testify. Number two, your client supplied no evidence, zero evidence, with respect to rebutting the summary judgment motion from the FAA. And number three, your client supplied no affidavit indicating that he believed what his attorney said was his misunderstanding. We have an attorney representation. We have no affidavit. We have no evidence. We have no testimony. Is that right?
You're right, Your Honor. We have no affidavit. We have no testimony. But Mr. Mannin was there at hearing before the judge prepared to do that, but was shut down early and was not able to do that, is what we maintain.
While we're on that, I have a little difficulty understanding how anyone could contend that the term misdemeanor does not include minor misdemeanors. It's rather like saying the term rabbit doesn't include small rabbits.
Your Honor, there is a lot of that discussion in the record about whether that is a plausible defense or a plausible statement that Mr. Mannin would make and would be credible or not. But again, we did not reach that as to whether that was something that Mr. Mannin could be believed to have misunderstood. His credibility was not judged. He did not testify.
He didn't offer anything.
Other than a denial, Your Honor.
That he had such a belief. I really have a hard time understanding it, Counsel.
I know, Your Honor. And we do have a denial in the pleadings. We do have responses to discovery and discovery documents that were evidencing his position all along.
I'm sorry, is there some place in the record where he proffers as what he would say if testifying that paralleled what the lawyer represented, namely this in some states doesn't count as it's called summary rather than a
summary of sentences?
Right.
I believe we referenced those in, maybe it was our reply brief, where we pointed out that in response to discovery responses, that's where Mr. Mannin would have verified that his understanding of the offenses were such that he did not believe they merited response. I believe on page 6 of our reply brief, we talk about asserted due to the passage of time, respondent doesn't remember circumstances or details. Went to the courthouse, unable to find anything. And I believe in the answer, if you look at the answers as well.
Where are they in the appendix?
Record page 31 is the first. This is the second answer. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Is there an appendix page on that?
The joint appendix page 31 is the reference to the second answer that was filed by Mr. Mannin, but I believe it's identical in the first answer, where Mr. Mannin, in paragraph 49 on that page, specifically says that respondent report non-traffic, his belief that the disorderly charge was a minor summary offense would not have to be reported.
This term summary offense, your trial counsel referred to that unique to Ohio, they don't use the term summary offense. I'd never heard the term used to refer to something like this in the years that I practiced law. So I went back to the Westlaw for the state I practiced in. It didn't occur there. It doesn't occur in D.C. law. I picked another couple of states at random. It didn't occur there. So where this term summary offense may be specific to some state, but it's not the one where the events occurred here. other than the lawyer suggesting it to him, where did he come up with the term summary offense?
Your Honor, as far as summary offense versus misdemeanor or felony, I'm not very familiar with those kinds of words. I don't practice that kind of law, and I don't know in the context of this case where Mr. Mannin came up with that as part of his thinking. We might have had that opportunity to know that if he had been able to testify on the merits of the case.
Don't leave without talking about your laches defense or your departure from unexplained departure from prior agency precedent. Please go ahead to that unless my colleagues have further questions.
I have just one question before you get to that. The attorney for Mr. Mannin said in several places that he wasn't making any factual contention. He said, my position is a legal argument, that as a matter of law, that these are not misdemeanors that he pled to. Isn't that correct?
That was one of the arguments, Your Honor, on the three prongs.
I'm not talking about latches. I'm talking about on
right, on the intentional falsification, there were three prongs, and one of the prongs was whether the statement was in fact false. And one argument that Mr. Mannin was making was that this answer was not false. It was not a misdemeanor.
I don't even see an argument that first of all, the attorney, the Mannin wasn't even present. The attorney said he had never met Mr. Mannin.
Correct.
Before. And he's making his representation. He never met Mr. Mannin.
He had spoken with Mr. Mannin on the phone.
But what I fail to see is any representation that, look, even me as the attorney, even if I am incorrect about Ohio law, Mr. Mannin believed that Ohio law treated these matters as summary offenses and not misdemeanors. I don't see that. Does the attorney make that representation? Even whether that's sufficient or not without an affidavit is another question. But does the attorney even make that representation? I don't see it.
Just to understand your question, Your Honor, you're asking whether the attorney made the representation that this was Mr. Mannin's thinking at the time?
Yeah.
I believe he did.
I thought the representation was that Mr. Mannin didn't remember much of anything about these things.
I agree with that was also in there, that the details were sketchy. There was memory concerns and losses. Memories had faded. But that to the best of his knowledge, which if you look at the bottom of the medical application form, when you sign the medical application form, it's saying that these answers are true and accurate to the best of my knowledge. And that's the measure by which Mr. Mannin should be held in identifying whether he actually knew that his answers on the question, that his answers on the form were in fact intentionally false.
One more question before you get the latches and the if we treat this case as a question of substantial evidence to support the decision of the administrative agency, and we disagree with you with respect to whether your client had an opportunity to present evidence, then what is your argument regarding the lack of substantial evidence to support the judgment of the board?
The lack of evidence is the, at least as it relates to the most contested issue, is the third prong of the Hart-Fumi-Klucas standard affirmed by this court, that there was actual knowledge that Mr. Mannin knew his answer was wrong.
Can we treat the attorney's statement that these were minor misdemeanors as an admission that they were misdemeanors?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that would be a question of fact that the judge would have had to resolve.
The question is Mannin's state of mind about whether they were misdemeanors?
Again, the two issues in the three prongs. One, whether it was inaccurate in fact, this is a summary offense the same as a minor misdemeanor. And then the other prong is to whether Mr. Mannin in fact actually knew that he knew the difference and could connote that in answering the question. Yes, Your Honor. And I see, Your Honor, that I'm running out of time, but if I could address latches, if you have specific questions.
We do have a brief on it, but go ahead and hit it briefly. And give her 2 minutes, and we'll hear you on the latches briefly.
All right, Your Honor, much has been made about the fact that latches was an issue in this case and not properly resolved. at least on summary judgment. And I don't want to get caught up on the word latches, because it's whether it's latches or something else that you want to call it, there is the equitable doctrine embodied in this NTSB case law that the delay in the prosecution of a case that results in prejudice to the airman in defending can be used as a basis to dismiss charges. And we maintain that in the context of this case, that was a separately asserted affirmative defense. It got caught up in the context of stale complaint, but it nonetheless remained independent and individual for purposes of an affirmative defense that Mr. Mannin was again precluded from presenting. A hearing on the merits, presumably Mr. Mannin would have been able to testify, produce documents, if there were the ones that he could proffer, about how he went to gather evidence to support his contention that these were what his mindset was, were about what his mindset was, but he could not bring that information forth because the 13 and 15 years had passed.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. We'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Hear from the respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Agnes Rodriguez, representing the Federal Aviation Administration. In this case, once the FAA established a prima facie case of intentional falsification.
Why don't you start with latches?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the unexplained departure from prior agency practice.
Well, with respect to the latches, Mr. Mannin has argued in this court that the NTSB's failure to acknowledge that it will consider a latches defense outside of its stale complaint rule constitutes a change in policy without explanation and is reversible error. But in actuality, when you look at the statement that was made, while it was not in fact an embodiment of the entire case law of the NTSB, it was in fact an accurate statement of what was before this this board on review. Any error with respect to not acknowledging or citing that case law as to when it would entertain a latches claim outside its stale complaint rule was at worst harmless here. Because
I didn't understand the argument to be one of failure to cite a case. I understood the argument to be failure to inquire into to look at the latches defense because of a theory that I thought the board of FAA now conceded was mistaken, namely that it had to be associated with the stale complaint.
Well, the posture of this case was on summary judgment, and Mr. Mannin did assert in his initial pleading an affirmative defense that included a separate latches under the equitable doctrine of latches, as well as the stale complaint. And he made an initial pleading in his answer, amended answer to that effect. But this was summary judgment. And
Nonetheless, we're coming to the point that the decision was made without considering that independent defense, apparently on the theory that our precedent is, our practice is, we only consider latches in conjunction with the stale complaint. Then you now concede, do you not, that that's not an accurate statement of prior agency practice?
It's not an accurate statement with respect to the proposition that was stated. But on this particular record, what is clear from that precedent, even that precedent that was not acknowledged in that statement, is that it is the airman's burden to if the airman wants to demonstrate a separate latches claim outside of the stale complaint rule, it is the burden is on the airman to come forward with evidence to establish that the airman suffered actual
doesn't that
actual
have to be adjudicated though under the standards theretofore established by agency practice without an unexplained departure from agency practice.
Well, it doesn't represent an unexplained departure. It has to be.
I thought you had conceded that it did.
Well, it's not an embodiment of the law. It isn't the agency's practice to completely disregard. But the precedent places the burden on the airman to come forward and demonstrate actual prejudice.
The board never considered that question at all, right?
Well, on the record,
the board simply rejected it because of this theory that it's got to be involved with the stale complaint rule. So there's no ruling before us whatsoever on insufficiency of Manin's evidence or proffer with respect to the effect of the delay.
Mr. Manin's proffer was nothing more than what he stated in his initial pleading and what he argued in advancing his claim.
There's no ruling on that, right? Yeah.
Well, but in advancing his claim in opposition to the motion for summary judgment, it was his burden to come forward with whatever evidence
We have no board ruling on that issue at all.
Well, but you in effect do, because Mr. Manin only argued latches in the context of the stale complaint rule.
What you're essentially arguing, if I hear you correctly, is that in order for latches to apply, it is incumbent in this situation, the stale complaint rule doesn't apply because it goes to his qualifications. And that doesn't apply when it goes to the qualifications. But in order for latches to kick in, it's an affirmative defense, and it's incumbent upon the airman to present evidence of prejudice. He never presented any evidence of prejudice. So regardless of what the board said, it was harmless error.
That's correct, Your Honor.
It's just harmless error. They would have ruled against him anyway.
That's right. And if they had, if there's really no remedy that would alter the conclusion here with respect to what was presented as Mr. Manin's only latches defense, and that was in the context of the stale complaint rule. If the board had analyzed this...
Outside the context of the stale complaint rule, mm-hmm. Do we have before us board rulings on what is required to show what evidence is necessary to make out a defense of latches?
Well, the defense of latches is established by, two elements. One is that the unreasonable delay of another party resulted in actual prejudice to the airman's ability to defend himself against the charges, and that prejudice warrants a dismissal of the case on that basis. But it's also...
That seems very conclusory, and I guess the question would be how far does the airman have to go in showing this prejudice? Because the premise is that because of the passage of time, records have disappeared and memories have lapsed. As far as the memories have lapsed issue is concerned, if you don't have the memory of something 15 years before, I'm not sure what you can say about that.
Well, it's also important to recognize that latches is an equitable defense. And in order to receive equity, the person has to give equity. In this particular case,
these aren't the grounds on which the board ruled at all.
Well, but it's important to understand the context of the record and whether there's really anything that there's any meritorious latches issue to be addressed by the board. His initial pleading of the he did make an affirmative defense in which he pled latches, but it was on its face deficient. It did not assert the essential elements of
latches.
Did
the board ever rule that?
No, it didn't. But even if the board were to go back,
have you offered us precedents from the board indicating that was the inevitable outcome?
Well, the board has stated in Administrator versus Peterson that while an airman is free to attempt to demonstrate a separate latches defense outside of its stale complaint rule, that conclusory allegations regarding the unavailability of witnesses and evidence is going to be insufficient. And that's why I bring the court back to the posture of this case, is that we were on summary judgment. This was an affirmative defense on which Mr. Manin would bear the burden of proof. He needed to come forward with specific facts to support his latches defense if, in fact, he wanted to succeed in convincing a judge that his latches defense merited a hearing on the merits. And in this particular case, all Mr. Manin had made was a very vague assertion of prejudice with respect arising from the fact that after so many years, unidentified witnesses, unidentified information are no longer available to him. That is not sufficient information from which a reasonable fact finder can even discern whether any of this unidentified evidence is even relevant to his defense of the charges here. And the defense.
All of that might be terribly convincing if the agency had said, but nobody's mentioned Chenery, but we can't affirm an agency on the basis of different than what the agency used, can we?
Well, the
harmless error is a very slim doctrine with respect to administrative law. When we're reviewing district courts, we can affirm them on any basis. But when we're reviewing an administrative agency, we cannot go back and supply a different rationale than that supplied by the agency, can we?
Well, and you know, under the APA, the judicial determinations under the APA are to be informed by, you know, the standard of whether there's prejudicial error in this case. And in this case, the fact that the NTSB did not go and do that further analysis is not prejudicial here. It's harmless error, as Judge Randolph had pointed out, because it wouldn't matter. The way that Mr. Mannin advanced his latches argument before the judge on summary judgment was strictly within the context of the stale complaint rule. And the NTSB ruled was strictly
now
within.
We're back to that.
Yes.
You flip back and forth in a way that's distressing, because I thought we were dealing with the question of whether the board properly disposed of the, or its failure to properly dispose of the Lachey's argument outside the stale complaint context was adequate.
The board properly disposed of the latches issue as it was presented in this record.
Didn't the ALJ made a finding that the FAA had not been dilatory in bringing the complaint, that it had been that it didn't unreasonably delay?
Well,
that's one of the elements of latches, isn't it?
Yes, it is one of the
and
elements.
And there's a finding by the ALJ that the board, or that the FAA brought the complaint within a reasonable.
The ALJ did find that the issue here, and this was going back, I think, more to the concept of latches under the Costello, that. That the public interest that was being advanced by proceeding with this particular action, in which there was an allegation of Mr. Mannin's lack of qualifications, made that, and certainly there was no evidence of that, and it was not, and that was, it was an affirmative defense that Mr. Mannin would have to put on, and he did not offer anything in opposition to that. But with respect, with respect to Mr. Mannin's latches defense, it was insufficient on its face in the initial pleadings. He was on summary judgment. He did not present any evidence to support a separate latches defense. The board properly decided the latches argument as it was presented in the record, and properly concluded that the stale complaint rule, which was the only context in which latches was advanced on summary judgment.
That's a possible reading of the record, but certainly not the only reading of the record as to how the latches defense was presented.
Well, it was a reasonable reading, and the NTSB, by virtue of its analysis of that, that was their understanding of what Mr. Mannin was advancing.
Yeah, but the question is whether their understanding was reasonable in the light of the actual record.
And their understanding, we would submit it was, because Mr. Mannin, despite having made a conclusory assertion of an affirmative defense, only advanced unreasonable delay under the stale complaint rule. The NTSB ruled that that particular rule under the NTSB procedures did not apply in this case, and Mr. Mannon has not challenged that determination in this court.
Can we turn to the chenery issue on the substantive problem? When I look at the board decision of pages 136, 137 of the joint appendix, it seems to rest on a theory wholly inconsistent with Dillman, as let's say Dillman in this circuit. what it cites is the board's own decision of Dillman reversed by the circuit. The key sentence I think is this: a respondent's incorrect answers on his medical applications amount to an intentional falsification under board precedent when the respondent was cognizant of their falsity.
Yes.
Without, so,
well, but
where is the consideration of subjective understanding there?
Well, under board case law, prior Mannon decision back in 1994, as well in Reynolds, Administrator versus Reynolds, board has stated that prima facie proof of intentional falsification of a medical record, which would include the first element.
Sorry, prima facie intentional falsification?
Prima facie proof of intentional falsification, which is the violation here, is established by showing evidence of the medical applications that had the false information contained on them and evidence of the convictions that were not reported on those medical applications, that the presentation of that evidence is prima facie proof under case law.
That's not what the board says. I mean, here, page 1.
Well, no, and
we have previously rejected a respondent's own interpretation of the requirements of a medical certificate. Well, it seems to me Dillman in this circuit suggests that the respondent's own interpretation is a very significant thing and may be a defense.
It is, but in the context of this case, in which the argument that was presented on summary judgment on behalf of Mr. Mannon by his counsel was the falsity of the statement, and we established by presenting the medical records and the certified court documents that absent an explanation from Mr. Mannon to rebut that evidence, then the inference drawn by NTSB precedent is that is circumstantial evidence of intentional falsification. So
where is it that the board says that?
Well, it says it.
I don't see this sort of prima facie case.
Well, on page, I think it was page 4 of the NTSB's decision, I think. Let me see here. Yes, on page 4, which is page 131 of the joint appendix, the board is laying out the fact that at the hearing that the administrator, instead of putting on witnesses, laid out evidence of the certified documents showing the charges, the certified copy of his conviction and his airman medical record. What they're describing in that first partial paragraph is what is the prima facie case under cases like Mannon, the 1994 case, and Reynolds, Administrator versus Reynolds. Then, in the following paragraph, the first full paragraph, the NTSB notes that Mr. Mannon did not testify. He did not provide any evidence at any stage of the proceedings before the ALJ. He did not testify on any material facts in this case, and that he only presented the arguments of his counsel. And I think we all understand that the arguments of counsel are not themselves evidence. And so in this case, what you have here is prima facie proof under established board precedent of intentional falsification, which has remained unresponded to by Mr. Mannon, who never came forward by way of any affidavit, by way of any other affirmative evidence in opposition to the summary judgment.
Well, purely a summary judgment question. The board, as I understand it, is not bound by the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, but looks to them for guidance. Is that the
That is correct.
And the law as established in a series of Supreme Court cases is that you cannot rest in response to a motion for summary judgment, you cannot rest on the pleadings. You have to present evidence that would be admissible in a form that would be admissible at trial in order to rebut the whatever the evidence is that the other side presents. And in a situation like this, the evidence would, I'd presumably, since the what we're arguing, hearing argument about is the state of mind of the airman, the evidence would consist of an affidavit, at a minimum. I mean, it's sometimes deposition testimony, but at a minimum, affidavit. So if this case, I think, and I'll ask counsel for the airman, so if this case were in a federal district court, it seems to me that summary judgment would be proper because there was no response in terms of any kind of evidentiary presentation. Now, I may be wrong about that, but I think that's a fair statement of the law of summary judgment.
And I agree with that, Your Honor, and I think that the NTSB has also stated that in its for purposes of its own application of summary judgment in its proceedings. In Administrator versus Eggleston, the board said that a bald assertion absent corroborating evidence is insufficient to rebut the administrator's prima facie case on summary judgment. And at the end of the day here, all that Mr. Mannin's initial pleadings and all of his arguments through his counsel on the record before the judge amounted to nothing more than that. They were simply uncorroborated, bald assertions. And summary judgment was properly granted in this case because the standard for entering summary judgment was met. In the absence of a genuine issue of material
fact. There's an ambiguity in the board's decision, whether there are mistakes but there's ambiguity. And the ambiguity is that when the board is referring to respondent this and respondent that, it's not clear whether what the board is referring to is the airman mm-hmm. or instead the attorney. And when it says that we don't have to take the attorney's interpretation, I mean, if you substitute for respondent on the pages 136 or whatever, 137, if you substitute the word the attorney, we don't have to take the attorney's interpretation of the, you know, what the form requires. That's a perfectly accurate statement.
And I think that that's an appropriate, I think that's an accurate assertion of what the board was trying to convey here. And that's why I pointed out on
page. Because they don't have any presentation from evidentiary presentation from the defendant.
At any stage of this proceeding, Mr. Mannin has remained utterly silent. On Joint Appendix page 131, again, the board made the point of saying, in response to the administrator's case, the respondent did not testify but presented the arguments through his counsel. And I think as you consider the totality of what the NTSB says, rather than, you know, looking at a word here or there in isolation, and certainly looking at it in the context of the record in this case, this is wholly distinguishable from Dillman. This is not a case where the NTSB ignored the subjective understanding that the airman testified to and disregarded the credited which the ALJ had credited in Dillman. This is also nothing like Singleton, which was a case that was decided on summary judgment, but then reversed by this court and remanded for further proceedings. In that case, this court found that Mr. Singleton's explanation for why it was that he answered a slightly different question the way that he did was adequately supported by affidavits and other evidence that was before the judge by Mr. Singleton himself, and that what was presented before the judge was, in the court's view, sufficient to have survived summary judgment in this case.
Yeah, here, I've looked again at what I just said. I think maybe it's too much of a stretch to say that line really refers to what the counsel was saying. I mean, in context, it probably is a reference to the airman. But anyway.
Yeah, I think your time expired some time ago, and we've, as we often do, kept you on your feet while we explored the subject with you, so
I appreciate
unless
the
my
course.
Colleagues have further questions, your time is up. Petitioner, I will give back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your
Honor.
Your Honor, just a quick couple of points. On the latches issue, Your Honor, Judge Williams asked, I believe, about the standard that's applied in these proceedings, and counsel for the FAA identified the standard that she cites in her brief to Black's Law Dictionary, and I would submit that the case law establishes the standard being that a delay in prosecution that actually prejudices the airman is the standard to apply here. And I would argue again that there is sufficient pleading of a separately pled affirmative
not
defense.
Not an unreasonable
latches.
Delay?
No, Your Honor. In fact, if you look at the
any delay?
Place law, it says a delay. Any delay in prosecution. Any
so
delay
a
in
delay
prosecution.
Delay is a 1 month.
It has to prejudice.
And during that month, a witness dies, then the defense of latches is regardless of whether the agency was at fault or anything?
The defense in the context of the NTSB cases suggests that delay in prosecution that actually prejudices the respondent, the airman, is maybe a basis for dismissal. Yes,
well,
Your Honor.
Perhaps more problematic to you, what do you say to the argument that there simply wasn't any evidence put forward on the part of your client on the summary judgment motion?
Well, again, Your Honor.
Therefore, no matter what standard was applied, you lose.
Right, Your Honor. And I would argue that, again, it was separately pled, that it was not in the context of the stale complaint rule, and that there was information put forth by the airman in the context of the pleading, response to discovery, counsel's representations of what would be presented that was precluded.
What about response to discovery would fill that need? Now, counsel's representation is a pretty thin read on summary judgment.
In response to the discovery responses, there was the representation of what would be presented at hearing on the merits of the issue. I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What is there in the record on the discovery responses?
It's in the record, not in the joint appendix.
Not in the JA.
Unfortunately,
it seems to be the day for that.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Your Honor. And in the context, again, of the record that separately pled, there was
in. Where would we find that in the record?
In the record that it was separately pled and articulated was in the airman's responses to the administrator's discovery, as well as then consistently in the appeal brief by the airman from the ALJ's decision, there were three sections, one section stale complaint, one section latches, and then one section on intentional falsification.
But the responses, were they, when you say there were responses, were they other than arguments of, legal arguments of counsel, was there any evidentiary presentation?
Your Honor, there was not the opportunity to have evidence presented
and
at the trial.
A judgment normally is an opportunity to present evidence in the form of affidavit or deposition testimony, at least documentary evidence. When you say there was no opportunity, why wasn't that an opportunity?
There was no affidavit. There was no deposition.
What about the airman's responses? What form did they take?
Responses to discovery, and
yes.
I believe they were also responses and requests for admissions.
Okay, but they were sworn?
I don't.
Or are they just
so,
the lawyer's ruminations?
The lawyer's responses, signed by the lawyer. I'd have to go back and look at them, Your Honor. I don't have them. I didn't prepare them to determine if there was any language at the beginning or the end. Any sworn issues. And on the intentional falsification, I would point out again, Your Honors, that the decisions in the in Mr. Manin's case, in this case, the judge's decision, the board decision, occurred before this court's decisions in Dillman and Singleton, identifying the proper way that these cases are supposed to be resolved. That is, an airman's subjective intent is directly an issue. And in the context of this case, Mr. Manin's case, the parties, the judge, and the board all were resolving it on the fact that the events occurred, Mr. Manin knew the events occurred, therefore there's the leap, tantamount, intentional falsification, which again, as this court has pointed out, is error. Thank you very much for your attention, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. Give us a recess.